The history of hormone therapy goes back over 100 years, and estrogen collected from horse urine was not the beginning of the story. If there is a theme, it's that history continues to repeat itself, and following the money is as important as following the science. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Long before postmenopause hormone therapy came on the scene, there was no end of remedies that were used to alleviate menopause symptoms. Cannabis, belladonna, opium, herbal remedies, and sedatives were all on the list. During the Victorian era, cold baths and application of leeches to the cervix were standard. The first documented attempt to replace estrogen was in the late 1800s, and it didn't start with horses. It started with cows. In 1896, German physicians prescribed ground-up bovine ovarian tissue to women whose ovaries had been surgically removed. This actually wasn't a huge stretch, since it was pretty standard at that time to treat thyroid disorders with extracts from healthy pig and cow thyroid glands. Interestingly, at that time, the goal wasn't to eliminate hot flashes, it was to give a boost to sexual function. A theme that's going to repeat itself. Now, keep in mind, hormones such as estrogen had not yet been isolated, but it was known that ovaries had something to do with menopause, since ovary removal resulted in menopause symptoms. 10 years later, in 1907, Merck, an American pharmaceutical company, followed the lead of the German physicians and pulverized cow ovaries to produce Ovarian Merck. So Ovarian Merck was actually the first commercial postmenopause estrogen therapy and was available as both a flavored powder and a pill. This product was recommended for, quote, disorders accompanying menopause, including affections due to atrophy and lesions of the genitals, the very troublesome giddiness, flushing, palpitations, nightmare, loss of memory, and insomnia. I actually wasn't quite sure what giddiness meant, so I looked it up. Basically, it's being dizzy. And while being dizzy is a known symptom of menopause, it's rarely mentioned today. Yet over 100 years ago, it was pretty much the first thing mentioned. Nightmares? Not so much. Now, keep in mind, back then there was no FDA and clinical trials didn't exist. New drugs were simply released to the public based on the idea that they might work. The FDA wasn't established until 1938 after a series of disasters, a whole other interesting story that I'll save for another day. Pre-FDA, it actually wasn't unusual for physicians to try a new drug on themselves first, and there is documentation of male doctors taking hormones, including estrogen, just to make sure nothing bad happened. As an example, in 1888, Brown Sequard, a physician, injected himself and his wife with extracts from guinea pig ovaries and dog testicles, which resulted in self-reported rejuvenation, whatever that means. But this may well be the first time a woman was given testosterone therapy. All right, so back to the early 1900s. Ovarian Merck was the only commercial estrogen product intended for postmenopause women for 20 years, other than an estrogen ointment manufactured in Amsterdam that was originally developed to treat menstrual disorders, but starting in 1927 was also recommended for the treatment of menopausal complaints. By the early 1930s, commercial estrogens were obtained from the urine and sometimes placentas of pregnant women, as opposed to various animals. Menformin injections use estrogen extracted from human placental tissue, human fetal fluid, and human fat from both men and women. It was the first truly bioidentical hormone therapy. Now, one of the primary symptoms it was used for was depression associated with menopause, which at that time was called involutional melancholia, which translates roughly to being sad because things are shriveling up. The whole idea of using high doses of estrogen from human placentas and fetal fluid was brilliant in concept, but never caught on. Something about the nausea and vomiting that followed each dose. I guess the estrogen levels were a little too high. Eventually, Organon came out with a pill form of menformin and also a vaginal suppository, which was intended to help with senior pruritus vulvae, which translates to old person's itchy vulva. But clearly, Organon was well ahead of its time. They had both systemic and local vaginal options. Now, at some point, Organon began extracting estrogen from horse urine instead of humans. Given that it took 25,000 gallons of urine to obtain 2.2 pounds of estrogen, it's obvious why the company switched from humans to horses. These products were manufactured in Amsterdam and distributed in the U.S. As a reminder, during this time, there were no regulations on the manufacture, distribution, or use of drugs. And the pharmaceutical world drastically changed when the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was passed by Congress on June 25, 1938. This first version of the FDA required that drugs be tested before they were brought to market in order to establish safety. They also mandated that drugs should be labeled with adequate directions for their safe use. And this was completely new and the beginning of requiring a prescription for drugs. At this point, FDA approval did not require that a drug be proved effective, only that it wouldn't cause harm. It wasn't until 1962 that a drug had to prove that it worked to gain FDA approval. While it seems unbelievable that prior to 1938, untested drugs with no proof of safety or establishment of proper dosing could just be released to the unsuspecting public, and that it wasn't until 1962 that a drug couldn't just make whatever claims they wanted about being effective without proof, let me remind you that as of today, the U.S. compounding industry has no regulatory oversight that requires proof of safety, proper dosage, or efficacy. The over-the-counter botanicals and nutraceuticals also have no obligation to prove their claims. I'm looking at you, Brooke Shields and Gwyneth Paltrow. More on that later. In 1942, the American company Ahearst merged with Wyeth, followed Organon's lead, and launched Premarin, pregnant mare's urine. So Premarin was the first version of estrogen therapy to be FDA approved for relief of hot flashes. It was advertised as completely natural. And it was. I mean, what's more natural than horse piss? But even then, they recognized to the general public, natural implied safe. Here's where it gets interesting. Prior to 1986, consumer advertisements for prescription drugs were illegal. So unless someone heard about a pharmaceutical product from a doctor, the only way to get women to know about Premarin was to plant articles in popular magazines. And no magazine was more popular at that time than Reader's Digest. Evidently, only the Bible sold more copies. So the first consumer article about Premarin appeared in a 1948 Reader's Digest piece titled, New Help for Women's Change of Life. The melancholy sickness that blights the happiness of some women at their change of life can be controlled by female hormones, yet most women have gone on suffering. But now, at last, they are ready to transfigure the stormy afternoon of life into a time of serenity and vigor. Now, that article, no surprise, was directly responsible for the beginning of an upswing in sales of Premarin. But that was just the beginning of the sales pitch. While direct-to-consumer marketing wasn't an option, medical advertisements and medical journals directed at physicians was fine. In the 1960s, Wyeth launched a series of ads showing that glamorous, happy women took Premarin, which in turn resulted in happy husbands. I mean, okay, it makes sense that ads would be male-centric, seeing as back in the 1960s, ads were directed at doctors, not patients, and pretty much every gynecologist was a man. I'm going to read you a typical ad that was used to convince those male gynecologists to prescribe estrogen for their patients. The tagline was, "Husbands too like Premarin." And then there's a picture of a handsome man and a beautiful, youthful-appearing woman smiling at her husband and having a lovely afternoon on a sailboat. The ad reads, "The physician who puts a woman on Premarin when she is suffering in the menopause makes her pleasant to live with once again. It's no easy thing for a man to take the stings and barbs of business life than to come home to the turmoil of a woman going through the change of life. If she's not on Premarin, that is. But have her begin estrogen replacement therapy with Premarin, and she is a happy woman again, something for which husbands are grateful." I know, you can't make this stuff up, but just Google "husbands too like Premarin" ad to see it for yourself. Did I mention my physician father put my mother on Premarin? I don't know how grateful he was, but I know she was. Between the Reader's Digest article and ads to physicians, sales were going up. But things didn't really take off until Dr. Robert Wilson, the Suzanne Summers of the 1960s, wrote Feminine Forever, a book that promised a fountain of sexual, mental, and physical youth to women who treated the disease of menopause with Premarin. Dr. Wilson used words like flabby and desexed to describe menopausal women and promised that estrogen would be a fountain of youth. This bestseller stated on its cover that every woman, regardless of age, can safely live a full sex life for her entire life. And even though the FDA had only approved Premarin specifically for the treatment of hot flashes, Feminine Forever promoted and promised that Premarin would keep women youthful, attractive, sexy, cheerful, and most important, able to hang on to their husbands, and that they would only have themselves to blame if their husbands did stray. I know you will not be shocked to hear that Feminine Forever was quietly funded by Wyeth, the company that made Premarin. It was truly a stroke of genius, the equivalent of pre-social media viral direct-to-consumer marketing campaign. And by the late 1960s, the estrogen boom was in full swing and prescriptions soared. By 1975, Premarin was the fifth most prescribed drug in the United States with almost 25 million users. Now, the first bump in the estrogen road occurred in 1976 when it became apparent that women who took estrogen had a tenfold increased risk of developing uterine cancer compared to women who didn't take estrogen. For the first time since Premarin entered the market, sales dropped. It was also the first time the FDA put a warning on the package that estrogen could cause cancer. By 1980, just 4 years later, this problem was quickly fixed by adding a progesterone pill to prevent any estrogen-induced buildup in the lining of the uterus, which in turn prevented the increased risk of uterine cancer. The reason they were able to jump on the problem so quickly is that Provera already existed as a form of contraception and was therefore available to prescribe right away to menopausal women to take with their Premarin. But think about this. Today, if a product was found to cause cancer and there was a way to potentially eliminate the risk, it would take years of testing to prove that it worked. But clearly, no long-term clinical trials were required to prove that Provera was protective. But it did solve the problem, so they got lucky on that one. And today, a progestogen is still routinely prescribed along with estrogen for anyone who's not had a hysterectomy. So once the cancer scare had been taken care of, sales again increased. A huge reflection of the trust that folks had in the pharmaceutical industry at that time. Now, while only FDA approved for relief of menopause symptoms, in the 1980s was when studies first suggested that postmenopause hormone therapy might also be beneficial in preventing heart problems, osteoporosis, and Alzheimer's disease. In 1984, the National Institute of Health Consensus Development Conference on Osteoporosis declared estrogen to be the best way to prevent bone loss. Experts were prescribing estrogen not just for bone health, but for heart health. The data regarding heart health at that time was front and center because it had long been appreciated that women prior to menopause had a significantly lower risk of developing cardiovascular disease, and after menopause, rates were equivalent to those of men. So clearly estrogen was protective in some way. This is not new information. We've known this for a very long time. In fact, back in 1966, in the Coronary Drug Project, men who'd had a heart attack were given estrogen to prevent another heart attack. I know, yet another example of men preferentially getting the benefit of medical research. The concept that estrogen therapy was cardioprotective in women was supported by the 1976 Nurses' Health Study, which ultimately concluded that women that took estrogen postmenopause had a lower risk of heart disease. By 1990, while there was some conflicting data, there were more than 20 studies that supported the finding that heart disease was reduced in menopausal women who used estrogen. And as a result, at that time, women were advised to routinely take estrogen the minute menopause hit, even if they had no hot flashes, even if they had no menopause symptoms, because there was the belief that it would prevent disease and prolong life. So in the 1990s, we thought we had it figured out. Women should take estrogen. Even the American College of Physicians recommended that hormone therapy be used by all menopausal women to reduce risk. So it wasn't just the gynecologists, but also the internists who were on board, and sales continued to rise. By 2000, over 20% of postmenopause women were taking hormone therapy. That translated to 90 million prescriptions a year and a $2 billion a year industry. In 2001, the FDA approved a combination of Premarin and Provera in one convenient pill, PremPro. Which brings me to 2002, the day the Women's Health Initiative results were released. I go through it in a lot of detail in other episodes, so I'm not going to get into the details of the WHI disaster, other than to mention that the WHI was not designed to determine if estrogen treated menopause symptoms, because that was a done deal. It was designed to determine if hormone therapy would prevent cardiovascular disease. And while the study was stopped in part because of the slight increased risk of breast cancer in the estrogen-progestogen group, it was primarily discontinued because of the increased risk of stroke, myocardial infarction, and pulmonary embolism. Now, of course, we know that that increase was in part because of the type of hormone therapy that was used in the study, but also because the WHI trials were composed of women with an average age of 63, of whom one-third had hypertension and one-half had a history of smoking. So most of the women in the study were a heart attack waiting to happen from the get-go. But now for the second time, the pendulum swung and estrogen sales plummeted. But unlike the cancer scare of the 1970s, there was no quick recovery. Which brings me to the Suzanne Somers compounded hormone era. The stage had been set. Women were desperate for help. They were miserable. Their own doctors weren't helping them. There was a basic distrust of the pharmaceutical industry that had misled them and sold them something that was perceived to be dangerous. And in swoops, a glamorous and youthful appearing postmenopausal celebrity who basically promised a fountain of youth with her natural, bioidentical, an invented term by the way, hormones that had no risks, only benefits. Suzanne Somers' best-selling book promoting those compounded hormones was called The Sexy Years. Again, primarily selling sex and anti-aging, not health. The message and claims were no different than the ones propagated by Dr. Wilson in Feminine Forever. And women bought into it. My little part in this whole history is when I appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show to counter menopause expert Suzanne Somers and make the case that her unregulated and untested hormone therapy was not the answer. It didn't go particularly well for me. I talk about the whole thing in episode 122, Navigating Menopause Celebrity Style. So here we are today. The situation has not changed with the likes of Gwyneth Paltrow, who's gone beyond promoting a jade egg and genital steaming for vaginal health, and now doles out menopause advice and products on her Goop website. So while it started with Dr. Wilson, we now have Gwyneth, Brooke Shields, and other celebrities who act like they're educating women, but what they're really doing is selling billions of dollars of products. And at least Dr. Wilson's menopause treatment actually worked. So why talk about all this? It's a reminder that when it comes to these products, both regulated and unregulated, it's not just about following the science, it's also about following the money. And while women generally distrust the pharmaceutical industry as being profit motivated, at least there is an FDA to provide oversight and accountability and make sure that all prescription drugs can back up their claims and that they report all safety risks and negative findings. Yet the general population seems to have little problem trusting companies that have no such efficacy or safety standards, but are equally profit motivated. Look, the FDA is far from perfect, and I mean far from perfect. It's the FDA that requires the placement of misleading warnings that have no scientific basis, such as that ridiculous labeling on local vaginal estrogen products that says that you're going to get dementia, blood clots, and breast cancer from putting a dab of estrogen on your vulva. It's the FDA requirements that make it insanely expensive and difficult to bring new drugs to market. It's because of the FDA that we don't have an approved version of testosterone for postmenopause women, despite the fact that it has been shown to be safe and effective. But it's better than having non-FDA approved drugs that are unregulated and unproven and potentially dangerous. Women need to know what works and what's safe. But we also need to continually question where information comes from, and who's really going to benefit? Information changes, new things are always being discovered, and it's important to keep learning and be open-minded. And like all things in history, it helps to know where we came from in order to move forward.
I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, and thank you for joining me. You will find lots more information in my Inside Information books available on Amazon.com. And follow Francie as she navigates her way through vaginal dryness, hot flashes, and pretty much every menopausal symptom you can think of.
Just